1, 2, 3, 4.
There's something fundamental about the value of art and culture, not just being integrated for vocational reasons, but because the experience of the arts or having a cultural element of one's life brings enjoyment or learning, relief, or any of the many experiences or feelings, releases that the arts brings when experienced, seems quite fundamental as an element of life. I think creativity is in any career, even in one's own personal life, in terms of approaching problem solving, relations with others, or how to be kind, compassionate, or having empathy. Creativity is a key part of all of those qualities, I would say. The arts and creativity and the cultural world at large is not a nice to have, it's an essential, and its value is fundamental, sometimes extremely difficult to define, and to see it lost from the developmental moments in one's life. And I think developmental moments in life come across all moments in the arc of one's life. To see that taken or ruined or made weaker or desiccated is tragic. And I think everybody who's involved in working with artists or artists themselves or being creative, everybody knows that and believes in it.
We have a figure from the heart of the London art scene, Hannah Berry, at a moment when the art world often feels centered on global mega galleries. Hannah has cultivated something truly unique in Peckham with her gallery and the ambitious nonprofit Bold Tendencies. She's created a vibrant platform for a new generation of artists taking risks and championing experimentation. She's been pivotal in shaping careers, and Harley Weir's exhibition, The Garden, it presents this intersection of personal archives, experimental processes, you know, the universal symbolism. How did you conceive of this exhibition and fitting into the broader dialogue of the artists using these new and unconventional materials in deconstructing traditional photographic practice, as I understand?
This is the second exhibition we've made with Harley Weir. And the first exhibition was called Sins of a Daughter, which was Harley's, a kind of introduction to Harley's work and world. And that was the first exhibition of her work to take place here in London. For the follow-up exhibition, The Garden, Harley had a very specific idea of what she wanted to present in terms of materials and the place she was in her life and world at this point in time. And so The Garden is a sort of all-encompassing term that she uses to refer to where she's come from and where she's going to, but of course drawing upon the universal symbolism and multiple symbolisms of the garden being a place of growth and death, a place of renewal and change, a kind of mystical, magical place, to an extent a sort of dream place, a place of form of utopian type of thinking. So there are many ways in which the garden is relevant to Harley at this point in time, and the works that we're showing come from across all of her practice. So some of the photographs in the downstairs were taken more than 10 years ago, but were printed specially for the exhibition. She's really looked at lots of different material that she's worked with over the years to bring together this one kind of singular presentation of the garden where she feels she's at right now. The show includes images of birth and very personal images of illness. Her father, who has a very rare form of dementia, is represented in the exhibition in photographs that are some of the only photographs Harley's taken of him at this time. And they seem somehow, for a show where many of the images are containers for so many different feelings and ideas and to an extent materials, the images of her father are almost the opposite of that, because the mind is emptying out, but the body is still there. So it's quite a privilege to be able to show those images along with all the others.
Yes. And so it's so interesting because the metaphor is at once personal. Of course, there's the biblical, we think of, you know, the ecological And then there's so many layers of like going, it's like an act of excavation, I imagine, the curation process of selecting. How do you go about that? You know, the conversations with the artist, as you say, you have a relationship that's going beyond one exhibition with her. So how do you approach that?
Well, the approach to Harley's practice is certainly excavation, or archaeology is quite good terms to apply to it, because, you know, we're always looking into something, or she's asking us to look at the structure of the thing or what lies beneath. Often the underbelly of what something may seem on the surface is what she brings forth through the choice of why she takes the photo of what she takes the photo of, why she captures that thing filled with this sort of less than innocent, a garden which has no of knowing, let's say. The garden, the upstairs, which is the most recent work, but it's work that is comprised entirely of her archive from when she was a teenager. So a lot of letters and souvenirs and things she was sent or received, things she collected, turned into these works on paper, which are almost like very flat time capsules printed. She made the paper and created the works in Japan, where she worked with washi paper, which allowed her to contain objects within the paper itself. Upstairs, in a way, is like the pre-garden of knowing. There's a sort of element of sugar-coated innocence to what you see up there, but also the works presented are not as innocent as they may look on first seeing. So again, it requires a archaeological or excavating type of approach in the looking, to look closely to see what the works really are. As to how we work together, Harley makes many, many, many works. So when she's making a photograph, you may have 50 or 100 negatives from which comes one image. So on her part, there's a huge amount of editing that goes on. And on our part, there's a sort of selecting from what she prepares. Because my colleagues, we don't look at every single negative. That's not our role. She's looking at the negatives and determining which one she prints and at what scale and how the work is cropped and coloured and so on. And then our role is within the selection thereafter. So yeah. It's interesting. With every artist, it's very different how you work and how you put the exhibition together.
You spoke of negative, the washi paper, the materiality of that. And then with negatives and film photography, it's a real music of chance as well. You know, there's an intention, but there's also what happens. It's kind of magic. You can be surprised. It's like one of discovery. And I think that this is something that we're, you know, a lot of us are, of course, talking about AI. We had Trevor Paglen on recently, and he works a lot, critiques of technology. And I think that so many of us are living this kind of flattened life, you know, so invested in the screen or these AI perfect outcomes that we don't even realize we don't get to go through that process. You know, everything is so fast. We lose the beauty of the slowness of discovery, or the innocence, as you say, everything is just done. So I'm wondering what your reflections are on that, and how do we hold on to our humanity, our creativity in face of so much rapid change?
One of the amazing things about works of art being made is that there is a making to them, whatever format they end up, or whatever form they end up taking. You know, somebody somewhere is doing something to determine that. And I think that's anything but flattening in terms of an action. I think it's illuminating and enriching and evolving and progressing the material that's available for those of us who only look at art or enjoy it or learn or whatever we do with it. I think it's a really enriching experience. Now, of course, I agree that our lives, particularly in the last 20 years or so, maybe longer, have become more and more engaged with a sort of flat world, let's say, or on the screen and so on. But that's only the dominant portal through which we find or experience things, perhaps. What lies behind that is an act of making, which is technicolor, three-dimensional, and so on and so forth.
Yes. And so the act of making, the act of experimentation, I know that your gallery has a strong commitment to experimentation and risk and discussion and debate, the whole process, not just the product of art. So looking back at the artists you've championed, from James Capper's kinetic sculptures to poetic narratives of Kingsley Ifill and Mary Jacoti, you know, how do you balance that commercial viability with your core mission of supporting ambitious and challenging emerging practices?
I mean, just key thing is to try to work as hard as you can on the things you've chosen to work on. I think it's a perennial, that's a perennial question that, you know, the balance, and or if it really is a balance. I mean, I wonder if it is a balance that you're seeking between commercial viability versus experimentation and risk. I would say that being able to work with artists and be a part, a small part of illuminating the work and hopefully gaining a wiser audience for it is one of the great privileges you can have. So I don't know whether decision making is driven by commercial viability. I think the gallery has to be a commercial entity and it has to undertake commercial work, or it has to, let's put it better, the gallery has to be commercially minded or commercially inclined in order to survive. I don't think that being commercially inclined devalues its commitment to risk and experimentation. I think one can, and as much as one possibly can do all those things, because also one has to be able to do different things at different times. But I think if all decisions were driven by commercial viability can be quite a narrow lens at times, especially when it's dealing with something it doesn't yet know. So I think actually the risk is the bridge between experimentation and what's called commercial viability. It's about, are you willing to throw out the rope bridge across the risk? Or the rope bridge is the risk, I suppose. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can't sit on the bank and want to get to the other side without being willing to throw out the bridge or the ladder or whatever you're going to use to get across. Otherwise, you're just always going to be on the other side, never knowing what was ahead of you. But so there is a part at which you have to leap into belief in the work that you're showing. I mean, it's easy for me to say that as a non-artist, but I have always admired artists for doing what they do in a way that is unlike what any other type of purpose. It's very different. And I've always thought it's pretty incredible to be able to play a small part in making those ideas happen or helping make them happen. So that's really always driven the program of the gallery and Bold Tendencies.
Yeah,
I hope that makes sense.
Yes, it does. It makes perfect sense, actually. You speak like an artist. And so I also understand that your gallery grew out of temporary projects. You mentioned their Bold Tendencies. I mean, was there a point, were you always destined, you feel, to be a gallerist? I mean, it could have diverged in lots of different ways, because Bold Tendencies is a nonprofit, you know, it could be doing events. I know that all of these are part of your programming. So what drew you to founding the gallery? Even why are you also, how do you also feel at home in these other activities?
Nothing really drew me to any of it other than actually circumstance. Circumstance brought the opportunity to me, both of them, the gallery and Bold Tendencies. I suppose I decided to stay doing what I've always been doing. So it wasn't that I set out with intent to do these things. I didn't. But I was lucky to start both things at quite young. There's a value and a sort of drawback in starting at the beginning and not really knowing anything. You're able to step into creating something from nothing. And that's what I think both things have been. And, you know, there's been both pros and cons and successes and failures along the way.
And what's exciting about, in particular, focusing on emerging or experimental, to me, it would strike me as being the most exciting because it's a real relationship.
I think one can create wonderful relationships at whatever moment you're at in your life. I think new things can begin at any moment in the arc of life. I think sometimes there's a conflation of the new and the young, whereas I think one can have, thankfully, we can have new and bold thoughts at any moment in our arc of life. But I've always liked being able to be helpful at the beginning of somebody's ideas or something they want to do. I like that type of work, being there at that point.
And there's, of course, an interdisciplinary element of different artists. We spoke briefly about having his inspiration from literary sources. I just wonder, in your curation process, as you're making dialogues between different artists and maybe weaving different disciplines or genres, what that selection process in terms of how works speak to you, how do you arrive at that?
Intuition, yeah, very much intuition. I feel something about the work that I've seen, and also I feel like there's something we could contribute to showing it or supporting it or helping with. In each case, it's completely different what the work, what the job is, but it's always predominantly driven by intuition and admiration. Come across something that stops you and makes you think or reconsider, or something you can't forget for some reason. I think it comes along in all sorts of different forms, reasons why you choose what you choose.
You know, it's interesting, and it's not always pointed out how gallerists or curators are storytellers. And I found through my conversations that sometimes the artists or visual artists are not always the best tellers of their story. Like, they tell it in paint. They think it in paint or photography or their medium. And then some of them are also writers, or some of them also make films or they do different disciplines, but they aren't always, they have the feeling that impels them to make the visual art that they make. So how do you, in being storytelling partners, when you encounter that, help form a story where sometimes it's just there or it's all in the work? And likewise, us in the audience or viewers, as we visit your gallery, some people engage very visually, but some people really benefit from that story to help them understand or help them feel it. You know, we all like learn and receive the world in different ways.
I enjoy how to unpack or describe or create connections between different works or bodies of work or different ideas the artist has. And because you are party to those on a regular and sustained basis, you can accumulate all those things and somehow find your own way to pass that information on when it's appropriate to others, whether that's through making an exhibition or just through a conversation. I enjoy language not as a game, but I enjoy language as a quest towards ever greater accuracy in terms of finding the words and the grammar to be able to explain best and with the most clarity what's happening here in the absence of the artist. What was it that was happening here and why? Not that one can always, in the absence of the artist, offer up the exact factual truth, but you can, with your knowledge and accumulated reflections and so on, you can get to that over time. I do think some good examples of that are when I worked very closely with James Capper in 2007, 8, 9, 10, right through to the current moment. We were talking about this just the other day. We had to together find these terminologies that would best describe what he was doing in terms of the language of sculpture. Like you described it in your introduction as kinetic sculpture, and I would say, well, actually we dismissed that then, and we called it mobile sculpture because we felt that kinetic was too, I mean, yes, kinetic is a word that can be describing moving parts, particularly in relation to sculpture, but kinetic also for me had connotations of a different time, whereas I felt that James is, when I first met James and encountered that incredible practice, there was no one who was really doing sculpture like that, that sat at the intersection of sculpture making and engineering, a sort of self-taught engineering practice. So there was this question of, it was mobile sculpture. And then there was a question of, you know, these sculptures are not just ideas or dreams, they are real things. And those things were mobile sculptures with a purpose and an application. And how were all those different sculptures, each with their different purpose and application? We then needed an organizing structure for organizing and classifying so that people would know, as James evolved his practice and pursued making all the works he intended to make, how might we then be able to order and organize them so that people could best understand this whole world that was being made here? And of course, in recent years, the sculpture has evolved again beyond purely mobile sculpture and engineering into elements of biomimicry and also with the project we've been working on now for almost 7 years. We worked on a project in Kiev. Now comes other humanitarian types of questions that have arisen from that sculpture as well. So the reach of the sculpture has always been very broad, but our job, or my job with him, was always thinking about how best to describe it in clear and accurate manner so that people could understand what it was, but also what it wasn't. And again, with George Rui, another artist I've worked very closely with in more recent times, so since 2017. In fact, just before I was speaking with you, I was talking with him about something he talked a lot about, is the idea of the bleed, the kind of place between the bodily construction, deconstruction, reconstructions that he's been sort of investigating, and the relation of the body to itself, to others, and the land or the place we step into every day. And he talked about the bleed as the ultimate sort of goal of the harmony of a painting that could present all these ideas in one complete position. And the bleed, he said that with the last two works that he's made, a painting called The Witness that's currently on show in the Met that was commissioned by the Louvre and the Pompidou, and a painting called Land Sickness, Supervision. He was saying that perhaps in those pictures he thinks probably he's reached the end of the investigations of the bleed and the surrounds that began more than 2 years ago. So again, it's just a question of language, not language for language's sake, but the right words in the right sequence to support the description of what's going on and the communication of that to a widest possible number of people. I think the same is true of, you know, working with music or dance or any of the practitioners, amazing disciplines of our time. And the least that one can do as a sort of administrator of all of this stuff that's being made is be accurate when describing it to other people.
Yes, you said bearing witness is, Kiev, you mentioned. I mean, I don't want to ever say that art has the responsibility to have social political perspective, but I can't help but do that. So as you look, we're going through pretty heavy times at the moment, whether it is the environmental crisis, whether it is wars in different parts of the world, just the growing disconnect that people have. How do you, as a gallerist and with your artists, how do you see your, I don't want to use that word responsibility, but we can't turn our backs on it. We can't close our eyes to it. So how do you balance that with the other kind of the beautiful pleasures of art? As you choose stories and exhibitions and the bold tendencies projects to bring, to produce.
I think when works come into your orbit that not necessarily comment upon, but serve to illuminate or ask us to reflect or consider even more than we may already be doing, or offer a perspective on the many crises, injustices, inhumanities, the things that people do to each other. You know, one can try to grow them and make them visible.
And with bold tendencies, tell us what we're able to do with that, that brings it beyond the gallery walls. I mean, I think that you help artists realize projects that they might not be open to or even realize were possible.
Bold Tendencies started as a sculpture commissioning project. The idea was that artists should be able to be commissioned to make a new work from beginning to end and show that work to the public in the summertime. And then we expanded the commissioning to involve the live performance world. And of course, we have a very strong creative learning program that sits between visual arts and live events. So Bold Tendencies was there as an idea, a way of making ideas happen. Quite simple. And I think that's what it does do today. Bold Tendencies started alongside the gallery 19 years ago. And that was literally just before the financial crash of 2008. Bold Tendencies has not just survived, but I think has thrived despite the challenges of and hostilities of the world out there.
Yeah, gosh, the financial crisis. You've seen a lot of changes, and I'm wondering what the art scene is like in London. I mean, then there's been Brexit. There's been so many things. I don't know how. Just taking the temperature, the artistic temperature, the political temperature, the man on the street temperature, what's it like in London today?
I feel very hopeful. I remember in 2008, just before that crisis, the big event that I remember within my professional life happening. Not the first event I remember in my lifetime, but the one I remember having a significant impact. on professional day-to-day life, let's say. And just before that, we've organised an exhibition, and the title of the exhibition was Optimism, the Art of Our Time.
Great timing.
Okay, strange. And then actually the theme of bold tendencies in every year, we have a thematic that drives the programme. So this year the theme is déjà vu and next year the theme is euphoria. But in 2020, the theme pre-COVID was tragedy.
Wow.
We retained the theme, but we sort of always called it the theme was suspended in that year. But we did reopen to the public, which took a lot of doing. And in fact, we did organise some of the only live events that took place with an audience that year. And it was clear that people wanted to get out and they wanted to get something out of getting out. You know what I mean? Perhaps that theme in that year. We then went on the following year. The theme was love and then crisis and then communion. They were the following themes.
Those are very intriguing, very good themes and very poignant and well chosen, because I know you choose themes in advance.
Yeah.
It's remarkable. I mean, we've gotten over it, but it did affect us in terms of there was that thirst, you know, to go out. Like, wow, we didn't realize what freedom was until we had to stay in. But then there was also this kind of appreciation of things, like the silence in the streets. Like sometimes you couldn't go out without a pass, you know, and then you just saw the beauty of things in stillness. I liked that. It was kind of like an empty canvas. As I'm an artist, so it was kind of like, wow, it's an empty canvas. I'm always waiting for, like, because, you know, as an artist, it's as much what you take, but it's, you choose, it's a curation process. You kind of choose to isolate things because you can't have everything. You have to reflect, but you have to choose things so that they will stand out. So that was a kind of interesting thing that you could kind of, oh, it's almost a curated experience because literally so few people, so few cars. And that was kind of a stark beauty. They turned, in my opinion, everyone kind of, one, appreciating the arts, like what they could do. Oh, wow, I can stay in, I can read a book, I can watch a film. They appreciated the artists that they just didn't think about, like what they need to do in this time. And it also kind of made people go back to crafts and things. So that was an interesting tendency, too, to see in the people who were not artists that everyone is an artist and they found their own way to it.
I think making things and constructing things in a time of extreme destruction for many people's lives in many different ways could have offered a certain type of catharsis, I would think. Certainly, if I think about my own life in times of extreme challenge and hardship, sometimes it's very difficult to think that the work, getting back to the work, can be a catharsis. But it is always in one's work, whatever that is, as well as, of course, if you're lucky to have people support, whether it's chosen friends and family and so on, but that there is a catharsis or a poultice. It can help having the work to do.
Yeah, I think so. And you described yourself, I don't know if you're optimistic or you're an optimist. And I think that
I refuse to abandon hope, to be honest. Practice, I will say. You've got to.
I think that being surrounded also by artists, and I think that curators are part of the artistic practice. They are part of the, I call them the invisible arts, you know, behind the scenes. They're called producers. They make things happen. So I think that that's all part and parcel because I know both ends now. So, but I think that being surrounded by people and being in the arts does make you optimistic, even when we're confronting sometimes grim subject matter, like we have to be a reflection of our times, because making something is positive. It is adding, it's not taking away from what's out there in the world. It's adding it and having the confidence to say the world is, or some people in the world are waiting for this, you know, like, so you have to, that takes an optimistic outlook, you know, no matter what. And a collaboration that not everyone, and see, like, if you look at politics, not everyone has that knack. They're all like at loggerheads. But artists, when they have to work together collaboratively, especially, they have to be optimistic, but they actually have to be very respectful because nothing gets done if you have an antagonistic. So I really feel like we can learn a lot from the arts and we can learned to get a lot done in limited means. And, you know, I think there's a lot of lessons, but we're not always asked our opinions on these things.
Yeah.
So looking forward, you have the continuation of the Bold Tendencies. You have, you know, what exhibitions are you looking forward to?
We're doing an exhibition of new work by Danny Fox, who's an artist from Cornwall, who will present in October. And then in November, we are organising an exhibition that celebrates the work of Norman Hyams, who's an artist who tragically died last year, to whom everyone here at the gallery was very close. It's quite a potent thing when you realise that Norman won't make any more work than what he left behind. And so we've just beginning on the process of organising that at the moment.
What brought you on your journey, your creative process? What drew you to the arts? Who were some of those mentors or teachers or collaborators along the way that you thought, wow, there's a place for me here. I really want to spend my time in the world of art.
All the artists I've had the privilege to work with have all been a great inspiration along the way. And in terms of that, they've been so generous and trusting to get involved with what I've been doing. So there's that group of people. There are many people out there whose work I really admire and whose example has been a source of inspiration. So people in many different walks of life, but certainly within the arts, there are people who have given very good advice, but also people who, through just going about their work and what they do, have been incredibly inspiring.
And what for you? I mean, now a lot of people turn to, oh, it's making money is important, technology is important, all the STEM, the sciences, all that is important. And so sometimes young people are funding at large is turning away from that arts education and thing. So what for you is the importance of arts and the humanities and having that integrated into our education systems?
I mean, there's something fundamental about the value of art and culture, not just being integrated for vocational reasons, but because the experience of the arts or having a cultural element of one's life brings enjoyment or learning, relief, or any of the many experiences or feelings, releases that the arts brings when experienced, seems quite fundamental as an element of life. I think creativity is in any career, even in one's own personal life, in terms of approaching problem solving, relations with others, or how to be kind, compassionate, or having empathy. Creativity is a key part of all of those qualities, I would say. The arts and creativity and the cultural world at large, it's not a nice to have, it's an essential, and its value is fundamental, sometimes extremely difficult to define. And to see it lost from the developmental moments in one's life, and I think developmental moments in life come across all moments in the arc of one's life, to see that taken or ruined or made weaker or desiccated is tragic. And I think everybody who's involved in working with artists or artists themselves or being creative, everybody knows that and believes in it.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you, Hannah Berry, for inviting us into your garden, sharing your curatorial vision and stimulating artistic dialogues, creating those conditions for risk-taking and experimentation. I agree, art is a powerful way of bearing witness and has the power to connect people in a divided world. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
My pleasure.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate Interviews producer was Sophie Garnier. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.